Peter Rollins, in his book, The Divine Magician, tells the following parable of the fisherman and the businessman. The businessman, while returning to work after lunch, saw a fisherman get up from the side of a river with a bucket of fish. Where are you going? Said the businessman. To the market to sell these fish, replied the fisherman. And how long did it take you to catch those? Oh, a couple of hours. Well, what are you going to do for the rest of the day? Oh, I don't know, said the fisherman. I guess I'll just sit on the beach with my family, drink wine, and chat to the passerby. But if you keep fishing, you could catch more, you could earn more money and catch enough to earn more money, said the businessman. Why would I do that? Well, if you did that, you could buy better equipment and catch more fish. Within a few years, you'll have enough to buy a boat and get a larger net. Why, eventually, you might even have a fleet of boats. And then what? Well, why then, you could afford to sit on the beach with your family and drink wine and talk to the passerby. I heard a related story recently from our resident labyrinth expert, Irene Glass, who said that she had the pleasure recently of presenting a labyrinth workshop and facilitated walk for a lovely women's group from a local congregation, not UUCF. And I do have her permission to tell the story. The members of the group were largely retired and over the age of 60. One of the things that she asks when beginning these labyrinth workshops is, you know, what drew you here? Why did you want to take a labyrinth intensive? What do they hope to learn and benefit from this workshop? And she said that this lovely group of elders, these wonderful women who have raised families, worked whole careers, survived spouses, done the American dream to the best of their ability, and done quite well in many cases, they all mentioned the same thing, that they were interested in learning how to better walk the labyrinth because of the meditative aspect of labyrinth walking. The reason that they felt like they needed an intensive in this is that they were finding that they didn't know how to slow down. Retirees don't know how to slow down. I want to invite you to consider that one reason for this phenomenon of not knowing how to slow down even in retirement is that our understanding of the American dream has shifted over time. The Jeffersonian ideals in the Declaration of Independence, that this country should be a land in which all people have the opportunity to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, has not only been on a positive trajectory, that Jefferson really intended that to mean landed white men, right? But that's been, the good news is that American dream has been expanding to include African Americans, to include women, increasingly to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender citizens of this country, so that increasing parts of our country have a chance at the opportunity of pursuing the American dream. But at the same time, the American dream has been increasingly incorporating some nightmarish elements of working all the time, of never taking time off, not taking all of your paid vacation time, and powering the economy through consumerism without end. So here, at the beginning of summer, a season traditionally associated by many Americans with vacation, a lighter workload, time with friends and family, I'd like us to take a little bit of time this morning to reflect on our relationship to work, which has become perverted to the extent that many of us have forgotten or never learned how to slow down, ever. Keep in mind as well that opening story of the fisherman and the businessman. That fisherman was already content in the present because he felt that his family already had enough. Contrasted with this rich businessman who was perpetually delaying happiness to some unknown future, a future that none of us are guaranteed. My inspiration for this sermon is a book titled Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream by a professor of history at the University of Iowa named Benjamin Honeycutt. It was published in 2013 with Temple University Press, and it's quite readable. It's a little less than 200 pages. As I shared with you in a sermon last month about the musical Pippin, I've done a lot of work through the years on the topic of vocational discernment. That is, how do you figure out what any individual person is sort of uniquely gifted and called to do with their life? Specifically, I shared with you three of my favorite guidelines for discerning vocation. The first, from Frederick Buechner, is that the place you are called to is where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Something that's deeply needed by the world and something that you deeply love. Or from a Robert Frost poem, he writes, "My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation." So basically what you do for your hobby with what you do as employment. "As my two eyes make one in sight, only where love and need are one, and work is play for mortal stakes." So that you're playing, but it's for something that really matters. And finally, Howard Thurman, who wrote, "Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come fully alive. Because what the world desperately needs is people who are fully alive and engaged with what they're doing." So there's much wisdom, I think, in those three pieces of advice, and there's one way of understanding them all is basically saying that you should monetize your hobby. Right? That's basically what they're inviting you to do. But here's one major problem. Not everyone is able to be paid well to do their dream job. Instead, to use a term from Karl Marx, the vast majority of humans earn a living through what is called alienated labor. So those three quotes we're talking about basically having a one-to-one correlation between what you love doing and what you're paid to do, and paid well to do, a living wage. But most people have what is called alienated labor, work that is not personally fulfilling to them, but they must do anyway to have a basic minimum of food and shelter. One example of alienated labor that is particularly immoral and inhumane and far too common are the factory conditions that many people are forced to work in, particularly in poorer countries, to supply consumer goods for richer countries. To give another example of alienated labor, how many of you have seen the 1999 satirical film by Mike Judge called Office Space? Any Office Space? All right. If not, the rest of you can go out and watch it. I mean, if you like the cartoon Dilbert, this is the film version. One among many hilarious scenes is when the protagonist, whose name is Peter, meets with two consultants. They're sort of been hired by the company to make recommendations, but everyone kind of knows they've really been hired to make recommendations for layoffs. And one of the consultants says to Peter in this meeting, "We're trying to get a feel for how people spend their day at work. Would you kind of walk us through a typical day at work for you, Peter?" But Peter, who has recently had this kind of enlightenment epiphany is shockingly honest with them, unlike most of the other employees. And he says, "Well, I generally come in about 15 minutes late, and I come in the side door so the boss doesn't see me. After that, I sort of space out for about an hour. I stare at my desk, but it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch, too. I'd say in a given week, I probably do about 15 minutes of actual work." One of the points that emerges for me from that scene, and really from the film as a whole, is questioning the value of demanding what is sometimes called presenteeism. You know, that there's this sort of value in workers being present for 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. And the question becomes, does a 40-hour work week actually maximize productivity? And kind of what that scene is saying is not necessarily. It may look like people are working, but you aren't necessarily getting more productivity from them than you might get if you gave them a little more control over their time. And regardless of the so-called bottom line of financial profit, even if that is maximizing profit, in most cases, spending half of one's waking hours in alienated labor does not increase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But today, the 40-hour week has become almost this incontrovertible fact, as if it were handed down from on high. But historically, the conception of what full-time employment means has changed radically. Many people used to commonly spend almost all of their waking hours working, sometimes up to 16 hours a day. However, beginning in the early 19th century and continuing for over 100 years, working hours in America were gradually reduced, cut in half by most movements. We also got things like child labor laws, right? So they were cut into half through things like the labor movement. which pushed back against the exploitation of workers by employers. And in the 19th century, extrapolating from the successes of the labor movement, many of the best economists and public intellectuals of the time regularly predicted that before the 20th century, we would usher in a golden age of leisure. So you go back, and that's what everyone is writing about, when no one would have to work more than 2 hours a day. It was sort of like they were predicting, you know, the Jetsons cartoon, basically machines are doing everything for you, right? So that those forced to earn a living through alienated labor, they would have to work maybe a 10-hour work week so that they would then have free time to pursue the American dream of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Instead of returning home from work so exhausted that you only have energy to veg out in front of the television so that you're, pass out exhausted so that you can wake up again and go right back to work. So instead, in the early 21st century, many of us work not a 10-hour week, but a 10 or 12-hour day and a 50 or 60 or more hour week. Some of you may have heard the proverb, though, and Charles talked about this some in the Story for All Ages. Some of you have heard this proverb, enough is as good as a feast. Because if you've had enough, you don't need a feast. A feast is fun every once in a while, right? Thanksgiving, these other holidays, we feast, that's good. But then you're often like, oh, right, the too much turkey or whatever. Or tofurkey in my case. So the proverb was that enough is as good as a feast. And before the 20th century, most Americans assumed that it would be possible over time with the, after the Industrial Revolution, kind of tracking the mechanization of things, for reasonable people to eventually satisfy their needs. I'll say that one more time. Most Americans assumed before the 20th century that it would be possible for reasonable people to satisfy their needs, to come to a point where they would say, I have enough. I don't have a feast every night, but I have enough. Sure, some people would still have more than others, but conventional wisdom held that increasing technological advances would soon allow everyone to have a basic minimum, and that increased automation by machines, both in the household and in the industrial world, would mean that humans could work less and have more free time because there would actually be less work to do, because machines were doing all the work, so humans would be free. This is how the theory went. Ironically, we now know that technological advances, such as smartphones, have in many cases moved us rapidly in the other direction to connecting us to work 24/7. Even on vacation, right? You can be in Singapore and still check your smartphone, still check your email. There's an additional factor as well, that traditionally too much wealth, too much materialism was actually understood to impede progress, leading to greed and envy, luxury, indolence, and selfishness. Those were seen as negative things. But instead of remembering that enough is as good as a feast, increasingly large segments of our culture reflect an ethos similar to the 1987 film Wall Street, in which the main character Gordon Gekko proclaims, "Greed is good." Many of the founders of our nation, however, had a much different conception of the American experiment, one that involved increasing numbers of Americans having more free time for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not, you will notice, the pursuit of property and luxury. Consider, for example, this passage from a letter from John Adams to Abigail, his wife. He wrote, "I must study politics and war, so that my sons may have the liberty to study mathematics and philosophy. And my sons ought to study mathematics and philosophy, geography, natural history, naval architecture, navigation, commerce, and agriculture, in order to give their children a right to study painting and poetry, music, architecture, statuary, tapestry, and porcelain." What else might we do with free time? So any of you retirees out there that aren't sure to do with your time, here are some suggestions for me, who's quite a few ways away from retirement. What might I do? Spend time at home with friends and family. Read the newspaper so that we can have an informed electorate. Read books for pleasure. Exercise. Join sports leagues. Spend time in nature. Garden. Visit museums. Learn a musical instrument. Join a band. Create art. Participate in community theater. Take time for spiritual practices like meditation and yoga. Take lifelong learning courses. And so much more. and much better than alienated labor. Rather than spending the best parts of our day and energy on alienated labor to fuel the so-called bottom line of profit, the American dream requires what is sometimes called the triple bottom line. Profit is still in there, but needs to be balanced with people and planet. That how we treat people and how we treat our planet needs to be balanced with profit. Along these lines, one popular bumper sticker supporting the labor movement says, "From the people who brought you the weekend." And labor activists did help secure a 5-day work week and in some industries even a 6-hour work day. But starting with the Great Depression in the 1930s and moving into World War II and beyond, the trend of shortening work hours reversed. And a new emphasis arose on the perceived need to grow the economy through perpetually increasing consumer demand. So we have to work more to buy more stuff, but we don't have any free time then to enjoy the stuff that we bought, much less what used to be known as higher progress. That the real progress was not buying more and more stuff, it was progress mentally, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, and in building up the community, instead of materialism. And recall that for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when he talked about his, you know, saying that the American dream, what he kind of called that was the beloved community. And when he said that one of the three greatest threats to the American dream, to the beloved community, in addition to racism and militarism, is materialism, is caring more about material goods than about people and the sustainability of our environment. Remember our opening story? A businessman, while returning to work after lunch, saw this fisherman get up from the side of the river with a bucket of fish. "Where are you going?" he asked the fisherman. "To the market to sell these fish," replied the fisherman. But the business was like, "It's awfully early in the day to be going to market, right? How long did you take to catch those?" "Oh, a couple of hours." "Well, what are you going to do for the rest of the day?" "Oh, I don't know," said the fisherman. "I guess I'll just sit on the beach with my family, drink wine, and talk to the passerby." "But if you keep fishing, you could catch enough to earn more money," said the businessman. "But why would I do that?" "Well, you could buy better equipment to catch more fish. Within a few years, you'll have enough for a boat and a large net. Why, eventually, you might own a fleet of boats." "And then what?" "Well, then, you could sit on the beach, drink some wine, and chat to passersby." Again, for me, a central question that is raised is how much is enough? If the traditional wisdom that enough is as good as a feast is true, then might we become content with less and give ourselves permission to claim more free time? You know, I just bought a house, so this is kind of fresh on my mind, and it's about 1,100 square feet. And part of what my wife and I have been talking about is, you know, maybe that's enough. And this isn't meant to be like comparison or inducing guilt, but that's part of what we're thinking about is we don't necessarily want to pursue an ever bigger house. I don't necessarily want to pursue an ever bigger congregation. I'm pretty clear for myself for the foreseeable future. This is enough. You all are enough. More than enough, right? Thank you. And we're getting more of you all the time. I'm a vegetarian. That's part of it for me is thinking about I've been a vegetarian since 1996. And part of it, some of that's not right for everybody as far as dietary needs. But for me, eating lower on the food chain, lowering my ecological footprint, that's enough for me and for my body. And so you have to discern what is right for you. There are important cultural shifts to work toward as well long-term in reducing wealth inequality and revitalizing our, in terrible shape, labor movement in this country. But beginning with ourselves, how might you feel called to practice the spirituality of summer over the next few months? Are you taking all the vacation that you're allowed this year? If not, is it too late to schedule some unplugged time away with family and friends? Or what can you do to maybe go ahead and get that vacation time on the calendar for next year? What did you love to do for hours on end when you were a child? Activities that you would get lost in the zone and spend hours passing by with you barely noticing. How might you experiment with reclaiming some version of those activities in your life today? For now, I'll close with these final concluding words from the historian Benjamin Honeycutt from the conclusion to his book, Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. He writes that higher progress, progress spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and as a community, that will be possible once again when more of us choose freely to liberate our lives from the economy, making the most basic of consumer choices to forgo new spending and luxuries. Modern illusions about the everlasting need for more wealth and work. Free people choosing more freedom is the best hope for the future. Free people choosing more freedom is the best hope for the future. Oh yeah, we're good time-wise. I'm going to tell you a little bit more. So I'm grateful, of course, to have what I feel like is, for the most part, incredibly unalienated labor. So I'm, you know, we're moving this weekend. You know, movers were there yesterday. We moved yesterday. I really should not be here today, but I wanted to be because I've been excited about this sermon for a while. I didn't know that this was going to be this weekend I moved, and I am taking a few Sundays off coming up. So you'll be taken good care of, though. We've got some good sermons coming up as well, but. Everyone does not have that opportunity, and that's part of what I want us to begin thinking about and continuing to talk about as a congregation and how we can maybe support things like the labor rights movement. And I see some glimmers of hope in popular culture. One, some of you remember a few years ago, I guess now, Timothy Ferris wrote that best-selling book, The 4-Hour Work Week. And I think that's one place where you start. Now, there's some problems with that book and the way he's leveraging a 4-hour work week on top of alienated labor in poorer countries. But nevertheless, I think that 4-hour work week kind of captured popular imagination about what might be possible and sort of reminded people that it doesn't have to be a 40-hour work week. It's also interesting to see there were things like in Battle Creek, Michigan, and the Kellogg's Company, there were a few other industries that even in the mid-20th century got down, they advocated to go down from an 8-hour work day to a 6-hour work day. And I'm interested in the ways that if that were our next incremental step, the way it might be more successful this time, because what happened last time in the mid-20th century, still in the Mad Men era, is that a lot of men found that 6-hour work week, they didn't know what to do with their time, and they would say incredibly sexist things like, you know, well, that's just giving me 2 hours for my wife to tell me what to do for 2 hours. And so I'm wondering, is we're starting to see a change in gender dynamics and men helping more around the house anyway, and you know, as opposed to women doing the second shift, working all day and then doing a second shift at home, that there may be more hope in as hours are decreasing that men might be more open to doing that, which will then free it for everyone. So I'm interested in seeing how that could change, but that is part of what also undermined the labor movement before. And then articles like so you may have seen in the New York Times, if you Google kind of New York Times, $75,000, it's just this guy out in Silicon Valley that is the CEO radically lowered his salary to pay every single employee down to the janitor, up to, you know, everybody. Everyone's getting paid $75,000 a year, kind of based on these sociological studies that have come out that say that happiness increases rapidly. The correlation between income and happiness is strongly correlated up through $75,000 a year. And then there's rapidly diminishing marginal returns after that, such that making increasingly more money does not actually make you any more happier, whereas up to $75,000 a year actually makes you a whole lot happier and a whole lot. Money can't buy everything, but it can buy some really important things. So that's just a few more things to keep in mind as you figure out where we all are in relationship to pursuing this. So as you continue your journey, continue walking in love, care for one another, and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you out into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Enjoy the summer this summer. Go in peace.